I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I am so excited for this show because we have Grace Young on. She's a Chinese culinary historian, and I've wanted to have her on for a long time. That's because she's someone I've been reading for decades. You know, when I first came out of culinary school, my head was full of French cooking techniques and terminology. And you know, the official line at the school was they taught everything through the French model because, you know, you can learn all the cuisines of the world through French ideas. And, you know, I bought it. But not long after I graduated, Grace released a cookbook called The Breath of a Wok. And I remember getting this little promotional postcard for it. It's a picture of this hand-hammered wok that's on the cover of the book. And I hung it up by my desk. I don't really know why I did it, but I just did. And, you know, for a couple years, every day, I'd just look up and see this picture of this wok. And then I realized that book is full of techniques that are Chinese. They're not French, and they're not really replaceable by French techniques. So Grace Young was the person who reminded me of that. You know, like, sometimes the real thing is the real thing. And now, 15 years later, she has a new mission, and that's to save another real thing, the community of Chinatown and Chinese restaurants across the country. Hey, Grace, I'm so glad to be able to talk with you.
Same here, Francis.
I remember during September 11th, you know, which is now almost 20 years ago, I worked in Chinatown, you know, which is a short walk away from the World Trade Center, and for weeks after the attack, maybe even a couple months, I remember the roads around the neighborhood were shut down. You couldn't get trucks through, and tourism disappeared, and Chinatown was just a shadow of itself, right? Like, so many businesses closed. And it was because these are just incredibly thin-margin businesses. You know, everything is cheap in Chinatown, and guess what? That means they have no buffer when times get tough. So even just a couple of weeks of decreased tourism and places were going under. So I want to ask you, when COVID hit in March, can you describe what it was like in the early days of the pandemic there?
Absolutely. Actually, the rest of America really felt the impact of COVID by March. Chinatown felt the impact of COVID in January. There was an immediate, the moment news got out about COVID, there was an immediate shunning of restaurants and shops and Chinatown. And business in Chinatown went down from 40 to 80% as far back as January 2020.
Yeah.
So by February, it was not looking good. I believe it was February that the ban on travel from China took hold, and March 12th or something like that, there was a ban on European travel. So by March, no tourists. We had the lockdown by March 15th, March 16th, and Mayor de Blasio only allowed takeout. All restaurants in New York City were shut. So Chinatown has never relied on takeout. That's never been a big part of their business.
Right.
So the restaurants felt it immediately. And I was in Chinatown almost every day, if weather allowed. I'd just take a walk in to just see how things were going. And in March, April, May, Chinatown looked like a Hollywood movie set of Chinatown that was empty. No people, no cars. You know, when you go down Mott Street, it's always bumper to bumper. You should sort of like plan on 5 minutes to drive down one block. There was not one car on Mott Street. Mulberry, Doyers, Pell, just completely emptied out. Hardly any cars parked on the street. But you have to remember in March, April, May, New York City was the epicenter. And we were losing 700, 800 people were dying per day.
Yeah.
So the effect on Manhattan's Chinatown was really sobering. And I think we had pre-COVID 296 restaurants. And I believe during the lockdown in March, April, May, maybe like 20 restaurants, or maybe just a handful of restaurants, were open for takeout. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So it was a very, very grim situation. But the grimness began in January. But that was shunning of Chinatown, because people were afraid they could go to Chinatown and catch COVID.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's because there were people, including our elected officials and the president, who, you know, were calling it the China virus. You know, they were very much eager to identify it with China and Chinese people. And, you know, that was going back, you know, that was when it was still just some vague threat. But you did a series of videos from that time too, from early mid-March, called Coronavirus Chinatown Stories. And I watched them. I watched you interview business owners just as the shutdowns were coming. They were in this incredibly tenuous place. I mean, I could see and hear the tone in their voice and the trepidation they had. What was it like talking to these people in that moment?
So I should just tell you, the background is quite by accident that I was in Chinatown on Sunday, March 15th. And the mm-hmm. only reason I was there is because I was doing work with Poster House Museum. And the director called me on the 13th and said, all museums have been shut in the city. We know Chinatown is hurting. Is mm-hmm. there anything we can do? And so I said, I've been wanting to go to Chinatown to interview the owners of restaurants and shops. And I think if New Yorkers could hear their personal stories and what they're going through, that New Yorkers would rally to their support. So she said, you record these stories and we'll put them on our website. And she said, how soon can you do it? And so I said, I'll do it this weekend. And I didn't even have a videographer, but I put a post on Instagram, got a volunteer, and we went down on the Sunday, the 15th, which turned out to be the last day that Chinatown was as we think of it. So without realizing it, we were in the middle of living history. The first restaurant we went to was Ose Peace, which is a Malaysian-French restaurant, and the owner, Mei Chow, said, I'm not worried, we're strong, I'm not reducing hours, I'm not closing the restaurant. The second restaurant we went to is Hop Key, which has been around since 1968, and he said immediately, today's the last day, and I don't know what the future holds, whether or not we'll reopen. And it was very emotional, as you could see in the video. He had tears in his eyes. His father started the restaurant in 1968. Most of the waiters in that restaurant had been with him for 20, 30 years. He brought us into the kitchen. I have never been in a Chinese restaurant kitchen that was quiet. No one cooking at the wok, no one chopping, slicing, washing. There were two customers in the restaurant, and normally there's a line out the door at 2 a.m. in the morning, 1 a.m. People are clamoring to get into Hop Key. So we found ourselves in this quickly unfolding situation. We went to Wo Hop, which dates from 1938, and I don't know how the manager, Ming, knew that 70% of the owners of Chinese restaurants had decided the following day they were closing, but he announces that to us. He tells us this is their last day. So it was tragic. There is one video we haven't posted yet, which is New Shanghai Deluxe restaurant, and that owner had tears in her eyes, and she was like, this is the hardest decision I have ever made in my life, but we're closing tomorrow. So we were there just by accident, just because Julia Knight at Poster House Museum asked me, like, is there anything we could do? And it is one of the saddest days in Chinatown's history, truly.
Yeah.
And this videographer, Dan An, that I was working with, we had never met before, and we both have tears in our eyes for most of the interviews that we did, because it was just heart-wrenching. And then we did an interview with one store, which is KK Discount. And Mr. Lee was just you know, talking about how business had been bad and down, but he did not say that he was closing the following day. But then a few hours after our interviews, that night, Mayor de Blasio announces all restaurants in New York City are closed. We were on lockdown. Mm-hmm. So everybody, yeah, that was that.
And that gentleman too, I remember later in the video, you come back to him in the summer.
Yes.
And he is reopened, you know, you can tell the masks are on and the whole thing. Yeah. And he had a line that really struck me too, when he said, you know, my kids asked me, why don't I just retire? You know, he just runs this little, basically a dollar store type of shop, right? Like, you know, he's in this tight, cramped Manhattan storefront. He's got bowls stacked up next to his head, like the height of his head. You know, he barely move in his store. It's like one of these kinds of old school stores. And I just can't forget when he said, basically along the lines of, you know, I stay open because this is where I see people. You know, it's not just his livelihood. This is his community. These are his friends. This is, you know, his customers who come in and buy a pack of, you know, red envelopes for Chinese New Year for a dollar of, you know, a stack or something. Like, these are his people. And yeah. I think that encapsulated for me too, like, one of the really heartbreaking and powerful aspects of certainly the stories you documented, but just the idea of whole neighborhoods, the economic lifeblood of neighborhoods getting, you know, shut down and drained away. It's like, it's not just, the businesses and the people and the jobs. This is how people connect with each other. You know, this is how people live their lives.
Chinatown is about human connections and people to people businesses. And for me, it's been absolutely devastating to see Chinatown go down, but also to constantly read that online business is increasing. Like, online business is at an all-time high. More and more people are relying on shopping at home. And when I go to Chinatown, I make like 8 different stops. Like, I stop at KK because I need to get like, you know, a new wok spatula, or I stop at another store just for their sponge cake. I have a favorite place that I buy my rice tamales. I go to my produce market to get my baby bok choy and my fresh ginger, and a different store for my fruit. And there's, it's little town America. You know, it's the way it used to be in America, or the way people romanticize, oh, I found Europe so charming because everyone does their shopping every day. They go to the bakery and they go, you know, buy their meat in a separate store. Well, that's Chinatown.
That's Grace Young, author of many books, including Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge. And she's currently leading a nonprofit effort to feed hungry people with food purchased from legendary Chinatown restaurants. You can learn more by Googling Grace Young GoFundMe. Coming up, we get into how Grace got her start.
When I was about 12 or 13 years old, I discovered Julia Child on television, and I was mesmerized. This was my favorite show. I sent a self-addressed envelope to WGBH every week, and they mailed me the recipe that Julia cooked.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode talking with the award-winning Chinese culinary historian Grace Young. Let's get back to it. I remember you saying, you know, one of the things that you really appreciate about Chinatown, that you love about Chinatown, and not just this Chinatown that we're talking about in Manhattan, in New York City, but in many Chinatowns around the country and even the world, they are sort of living connections, living bridges to the cultural past.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite restaurants ever in Chinatown, it's been closed for maybe 10 years, maybe more, a little place called New South Wind. I don't know if you know it or remember it, but it was never like a great restaurant in the sense that we mean it now. It wasn't like a gastronomic destination. In fact, the food was sort of bad, but I remember going there and it was as old as the hills. Literally, I don't think there was a person working in the restaurant who was under the age of 80. I mean, it was all ama, you know, just ama, agong, you know, walking around in four layers of shirts with their vest and their winter hat on. And they were walking the food from the kitchen to the table. And like one of the dishes they would have would be a mound of rice with a slice of ham, like just like supermarket deli ham that, you know, they just threw in the wok for a second, and a couple of fried eggs and, you know, a little drizzle of soy sauce on top. And they were famous for their dumplings, which were these giant, like, you know, in Cantonese cooking, the quality of a dumpling is often judged by the thinness of the skin, right? How delicate can you make the skin? And that is a sign of the craftsmanship and, you know, how refined that cook was. And I mean, these dumplings that they had were giant. They were like the size of your hand. The skin was, you know, thicker than pappardelle, you know, it was just like this thick, chewy, very not high level style of skin. And I just remember being confused by it. Being like, why would you even make it that way? And then a friend of mine who grew up in the neighborhood told me, oh yeah, New South Wind, my grandfather used to go to that place. And he loves it. And he loves it because it reminds him of when he came to the States in like the 50s or whenever it was. And there weren't Chinese restaurants really. And there weren't that many Chinese people. And it was the kind of cooking that people who came here from China, who didn't actually know how to cook, but kind of improvised or, you know, used some sense of memory and sort of like reinvented for themselves these dishes that would remind them of home, even though they didn't technically know, like have the skills to make them, quote unquote, the right way. But that became its own kind of cuisine. And there was a nostalgia associated with that. So that blew my mind. Like, I was eating lunch in a restaurant where the food was a direct connection to immigrants from different generations and eras that had to basically reinvent the cuisine because there was no way for them to otherwise have it. And that was the kind of thing that you could find in this neighborhood. It's just...
I know.
You know.
What you're bringing up to me, first of all, Chinatown is the last ethnic neighborhood in Manhattan. It's the last holdout. Everything else has been gentrified. So somehow Chinatown has been able to hang on. And what you're bringing up is exactly what has been completely motivating me to try and help Chinatown, because in the last year, we've lost legacy restaurants, exactly what you're describing. We lost a restaurant that is called WK Restaurant or 69 Bayard, 65 years in the community. Hop Sing on the Bowery, over 50 years it was in the community. Lung Moon Bakery, over 50 years. Hoi Wong, a restaurant on Mott Street, over 42 years. So there's only a handful of legacy restaurants left. But it's exactly what you're talking about, is when you step into those restaurants, you are stepping back in time, and it's a privilege. And my greatest fear is every single business that goes down in Chinatown, and there are 98% of the businesses in Chinatown are mom and pop, 98%. And they're all one of a kind. But for everyone that goes down, it paves the way for gentrification. And I can easily see a Trader Joe's or a CVS on Mott Street or on Grant Avenue in San Francisco if we let this happen. Because this country used to have 50 Chinatowns. And now we're down to the last two historic Chinatowns are both hanging by a thread. But you go to Washington, D.C., they have the great, beautiful Chinese arch. And right under it, the last time I was there, there was an AT&T building, store. Right. Portland lost its Chinatown. Los Angeles lost its old Chinatown. Philadelphia, just a shell of its old Chinatown. So it can happen. And the businesses that are remaining, they're all fighting for their lives right now. But the legacy restaurants, the ones that where you walk in there and, you know, we have Hop Lee, Hop Key, and the two Wo Hop restaurants all the waiters wear these old cotton jackets. They're not old jackets. It's old style. The way it used to be when I was a kid in San Francisco, and that doesn't exist anymore. You know, this is from a different era. You're stepping back in time, and there's just something beautiful about experiencing it. And these dishes, some of the dishes are absolutely delicious, like the lobster Cantonese from Hop Lee and Hop Key. It is just finger-licking good, and the locals love it. I went into Hop Lee back in November, and that's when we still had indoor dining, and there was a table of postal workers. And the owner said to me, oh, yeah, they eat here like 3-4 days a week. That's community.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So you are spending so much of your time and energy right now trying to save Chinese restaurants and save these Chinatowns. What can we do to help as well?
Well, the most important thing is to show up. Whether or not your hometown has a Chinatown, every town has a Chinese restaurant, a Chinese market, a Chinese shop, an Asian American shop. Since April, we have lost 233,000 Asian American small businesses. And back April, CNN and a number of other news organizations reported that 59% of Chinese mom and pop independently owned restaurants had ceased their credit card and debit card transactions, which implies that the businesses had closed.
Right.
So that is mind-boggling to think that almost 60% of the Chinese restaurants in this country have closed. Meanwhile, at the same time, P.F. Chang's announced back in March that their business had doubled, but they got $5 to $10 million in PPP loans. So my other fear is that the future of Chinese food in this country is that when you want it, you're going to be eating it at a P.F. Chang's or a Panda Express. That these little mom and pop restaurants that we love so dearly, that are the backbone of this country, right? Jennifer Ait Lee wrote this book called Fortune Cookie Chronicles back in 2009. And she says in the book that people think that apple pie is the American quintessential American food. But she says, when was the last time you had apple pie? And when was the last time you had Chinese food? So she says that Chinese food is more American than apple pie. So how can we let these Chinese restaurants like collapse right before our eyes? And I feel that people just aren't aware of how bad they're hurting. And I know restaurants are hurting all across this country, but no other restaurants were slammed with being blamed for the virus. So these restaurants and businesses have been hurting for longer, and they carry the extra burden of having been blamed for something that they had nothing to do with. So we have to show up to these restaurants. We have to order our takeout.
And order 2 meals worth of takeout, you know, like bring home, put it in your fridge.
Get your dumplings, because like by tomorrow, you'll really be happy that you ordered the dumplings. Or tomorrow night, you won't have to think because you ordered the beef chow fun. And boy, I can just like reheat that really fast and we don't have to worry about cooking.
Yeah.
So that's the easiest way.
That's great. Grace, how did you get into food in the first place?
How did I get into food? My parents were obsessed.
Sure.
With
I know that story.
High quality food. my parents were incredible cooks, but they made classic home style Cantonese food every night. But when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I discovered Julia Child on television. She had the French Chef show that aired from WGBH, and I was mesmerized. This was my favorite show. I watched every week. I sent a self-addressed envelope to WGBH every week, and they mailed me the recipe that Julia cooked.
Oh, cool.
And I loved reading the newspaper, and one day I discovered that Julia Child was coming to San Francisco. So I convinced my father to bring me to the White House department store for this book signing, and I had no idea what a book signing was. but I had somehow, this is quite incredible, a little 13-year-old a Chinese-American girl, has a copy of the French Chef Bantam cookbook. And I show up at the White House department store, and everybody there, I remember looking around, were all Caucasian women, sort of the ladies who lunch, as Stephen Sondheim would say, all dressed in really nice, like, nice suits and gold jewelry. I was the only child, and I was the only Asian. And I waited in line, and they all had copies of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize that they were selling books. So I brought my own paperback, and I got to the top of the line, and Julia and Paul Child were there, and they signed the book. And my father took a photo of me, and I actually mailed the photo to Julia, and she signed it and mailed it back. Yeah. And somehow over the years that picture got lost, which we can't even go into that story. But the main thing is, I didn't tell you that as a child, my mom allowed me to cook from these recipes I got from WGBH and the French Chef cookbook.
Oh, that's awesome.
My mother was a very sophisticated woman. She was raised in Shanghai. She had eaten French pastries. So I said, I wanted to make brioche. And she allowed me to do this. Yeah. And I followed the directions. And I will never forget the look of amazement on my mother's face when I opened the oven. And there were these perfectly domed, beautiful, picture-perfect brioche. And then the aroma. And she is looking at me. Yeah. And I pull this tray out. And when she ate it, I remember my mother giving me this look like, who are you? Like, how did you do this? And I was so, I didn't even know what brioche was supposed to taste like. So that's what got me interested in cooking. And I got into recipe testing and development when I was 16 years old. I met a food stylist and recipe developer named Stevie Bass, and she took me under her wing. And
wow.
She trained me, and she is one of the most incredible human beings in the world, and I'm still in touch with her. But
wow.
She trained me like nobody else. I ran recipe tests like lab experiments, and from there, you know, I got my college degree in art history. I ended up in New York working for General Foods, and then from General Foods, I ended up working for a book packager whose main client was Time Life Books. So I've done over 40 Time Life cookbooks. I was their test kitchen director and director of food photography. And towards the end of this period of doing these Time Life books, I thought to myself, I need to record my family's recipes. And I wanted to do
That's what I was going to ask, how you got into Chinese food.
I wanted to do for Chinese food what, this is very ambitious, I want to do for Chinese food what Julia had done for French food. And I think in The French Chef, or maybe Mastering the Art of French Cooking, she says, I wanted to take the bugaboo out of cooking. And I have always, when I first started doing Chinese cooking, I was in college and I didn't consult with my parents. I just opened up a Chinese cookbook and the results were horrible. And I think the majority of Chinese cookbooks out there are often very vague and the directions aren't very clear. And mm-hmm. and one, the main problem is most people don't tell you much information about the wok and how to season it and what to look for and how weird it is when you season because it's not quite like anything else you've ever done before. So yeah, I think that's how I ended up becoming a wok therapist.
Yeah.
I'm known as the wok therapist
because
I've given lots of directions and encouragement and support to readers out there who really want to understand and to really demystify Chinese cooking. That's always been one of my goals. So,
yeah. Right on.
And when Wisdom of the Chinese Kitchen was published, my first cookbook, I was invited to be the speaker for a Lunar New Year event for the American Institute of Wine and Food, and Julia was there. All came full circle.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, so I was able to give this speech and talk about what a huge influence she had been in my life and They seated her between my mother and me.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah. And then my father, at the end of the meal, is offering Julia Child a toothpick. You know, those little containers
at a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, my God. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 Baba, no.
I'm the child of Chinese immigrants, too. The toothpick offering that's legit.
It's standard. And so Julia takes the toothpick. My mother takes the toothpick. My father takes the toothpick. And they're all have their hand covering their other hand with the toothpick, and they're doing it. And it was like, I wish I had had an iPhone at the time, because that was like the shot.
Oh my God. How did Julia become an auntie?
Yeah.
Like instantly, like Auntie Julia's getting the toothpick.
And my mother kept on feeding Julia. You know how that's the Chinese thing. You always serve the guest to your left or your right. And I was like, oh, no, Mama, don't. Because she always, always overdoes it. But the more she fed Julia, the more Julia ate. Julia had this unbelievable appetite. Everything my mother put on her plate, she just cleaned. So I mean, she just completely like inhaled everything. And my mom was so happy and Julia was so happy. And then at the end of this dinner, Julia said, well, we'll have to stay in touch, Grace. And she says, do you have my contact info? And I said, no, Julia. And she reaches into her purse and I think, oh, I'm going to get Julia Child's business card. And she pulls out her checkbook and she gives me a deposit slip. And writes her phone number on the upper left-hand corner, which already had, I think, her address and phone number. So it was,
oh my God.
It was really like an incredible
moment. That's a power
moment.
Move. That's a power move for a business card. It's
like, yeah. And then she said to me, I hope your book wins Best International Cookbook, because it was nominated for an IACP. And a few months later, she was at IACP and it won Best International Cookbook. So there's a photo of Julia and me from the 90s.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was really, it just all came together. She started it and she was there when the book came out. So it was a beautiful thing.
That's Grace Young, author of The Breath of a Wok, a cookbook and guide to the most versatile pan on the planet.
There are a million different woks out there, but only a carbon steel wok is the pan that you need. There are Chinese-made cast iron woks that are incredible, but all the other woks that you can buy when you go into Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table, you might as well toss that money. You might as well contribute that money to Chinatown, because you're wasting it buying it on a wok.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a minute with more Grace. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending the episode with the wok therapist, Grace Young, and we're digging into a dark personal secret of mine, which is that I don't actually even own a wok. So, you know, it's been 20 years, two more books. You know, you have really had an extraordinary career as, you know, really one of our country's great writers on Chinese food and educators on Chinese food. I remember when Breath of a Wok came out, I had just graduated from culinary school and I was like, oh my God, like I didn't even need to know the translation. You know, I knew exactly what the title referred to, this Chinese phrase, this Cantonese phrase specifically, wok hei. And I remember seeing a promotional postcard for it and thinking, wow, it's awesome that someone just wrote a book about that, this phrase that I knew from my childhood that I never thought anyone, you know, who, you know, wasn't Chinese would ever know about or care about or think about. You talk about yourself as a student in or an expert of stir frying, not just, quote, Chinese food. Why that distinction?
Well, the last book I did is Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge. And I just think that when most non-Chinese want to do Chinese cooking, the first thing they want to do is stir frying. And I think that every food magazine, every newspaper, on the internet, you can find 1 billion stir fry recipes, but most of them are so poorly written that you're guaranteed to fail. So I wanted to just hone in on this one technique, right? Like Molly Stevens writes about roasting, you know? I felt as though I owed it to the public to do a book just devoted to stir frying, because that's what most people want to achieve when they venture into Asian cooking.
So when you talk about stir frying, like, how do you distinguish it from just, say, sauteing?
Oh, completely different, because when you're stir frying, you're on high heat. You need to be using an oil with a high smoking point. Mm-hmm. You need to be using the right, correct pan. There are a million different woks out there, but only a carbon steel wok is the pan that you need. There are Chinese made cast iron woks that are incredible, but all the other woks that you can buy when you go into Williams Sonoma or Sur La Table, you might as well toss that money. You might as well contribute that money to Chinatown, because you're wasting it buying it on a wok. You see, I can even find a way to get the conversation back to Chinatown. But a stainless steel, anodized aluminum, it's just crap. You're really wasting your money. And for sure, a nonstick wok only belongs in a garbage can. It is not intended for Chinese cooking and never stir frying. So please give that money to Chinatown.
Okay.
And a wok, a carbon steel wok, shouldn't cost you more than $35. And it will last you more than a lifetime. And it's indestructible. It heats quickly. It distributes the heat evenly. There's nothing in the world like it. Nothing.
I might upset you right now, because I'm going to tell you that I don't even own a wok anymore. I'm sorry. I feel like a traitor.
It's okay.
But
No, you're talking to the wok therapist.
But here's my deal, and I want you to explain this to me and help me get my head on right. Because my issue is that, okay, so I learned a little bit, not at any high level, but, you know, restaurant wok cooking, you know, with the burner that, you know, with the 155,000 BTUs or whatever, where literally if you take the wok off the burner and you turn it on, the flame will shoot up 6 feet in the air. And yeah, I get that. Like, that's an incredible amount of heat. It basically covers like the whole bottom of the wok, and you stir fry and you're in and out in seconds because there's just so much heat. I live in a home where my stove is your standard rental apartment type stove. Like, I don't have one of these nice, you know, like semi-pro home stuff. I straight up bottom of the line Frigidaire stove. And I just figured there's no way I'm going to get the kind of heat that you kind of need for a wok. So I don't have one anymore.
So let me just give you the background on this. The majority of Chinese Americans in this country do not have woks. And I'm trying to save Chinatown. And before I was trying to save Chinatown, my main mission was to save the wok. Because we're really at a point where the wok, after being in existence for over 2,000 years since the Han Dynasty, is an endangered culinary tool, not just in America, but in China. In China, they're selling non-stick woks. And young people aren't learning how to cook because there's so much food that, you know, restaurant food that's available out there. So, I'm trying to educate people to the wonders of the wok and what an extraordinary instrument this is. When I wrote Breath of the Wok, one of the things that was so incredible is that the entire repertoire of Chinese cuisine can be prepared with a wok. Yeah. Maybe you can't do Peking duck, but you can steam, boil, poach, stir fry, pan fry, deep fat fry, braise, and smoke. And since then, I've discovered that you can roast with a wok, and you can make popcorn, and you can fry bacon. So it goes beyond Chinese cuisine, and the pan doesn't even cost $35, right? You can do all these things with a wok, and people get caught up with the heat, and they've heard about the heat levels in the restaurant stoves. But for a home cook, you can achieve that heat, but you need to use a flat bottom carbon steel wok, The traditional wok is round bottom. If you put a round bottom wok on a residential stove, you have to set it on a wok ring to stabilize it. Otherwise, it's too dangerous. The moment you stabilize it, it's too far from the heat. And if you have induction or a ceramic glass top, you can't even think of putting a round bottom wok. But there are flat bottom carbon steel woks, and they sit directly on the heat. And so I do not own a fancy semi-professional stove because I am trying to replicate what a normal reader will have. So I have a KitchenAid stove, and I have a flat bottom carbon steel wok, and you can get the heat. And I explain in my books like how to test so that you know when the wok is hot enough, because you can overheat. It's actually dangerous. You could cause like a fire. So you have to know how to control the heat. So I flick a drop of water as I'm heating the wok. And when the drop of water evaporates within just 1 second, then you immediately have to add your oil and then you can do your cooking. But beyond the heat, people are so like focused on the heat that they forget that a great stir fry not only requires a hot wok and the right pan, but it requires the freshest ingredients. Mm. And so if you're trying to stir fry asparagus in December, no matter what, how hot your wok is, that asparagus won't taste great because there's no flavor. And the texture is like fibrous because it's out of season. But if in the middle of the winter, you're stir frying Chinese broccoli or Chinese baby bok choy, which is in season right now, right? Mm-hmm. The high heat and the quick cooking just accentuates and brings out the flavor. And in Cantonese cooking, we're both Cantonese, you know, like they're the masters of stir frying. If you have super fresh ingredients, you barely need to season because you back it off and just a hint of soy sauce or rice wine, or you could use dry sherry or, you know, just a hint of sesame oil just brings it up and makes everything sparkle. But it starts with your ingredients. You have to have the freshest meat and chicken or shrimp, and then your vegetables have to be in season. And that's when the high heat just makes everything sparkle.
It's funny because I think when we talk about high heat in most Western forms of cooking, it's because we're talking about, you know, searing like a steak, right? Like you want to slap the steak on a ripping hot cast iron pan that's been on high heat for, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. And because the idea is you're trying to apply a lot of heat to a big piece of meat because you want it to brown the whole thing.
Right.
What I think I'm hearing from you is the technique and the philosophy of stir frying isn't about that. It's not about searing the meat to get the browning, but it's about cooking it so quickly, and usually that's because that so things are already cut in bite-sized pieces, right? You don't have to like cook it for a long time.
Right.
It's about cooking it so quickly that it actually has minimal time cooking, and so what you're tasting is the natural flavor of the ingredient.
But there is searing, and there is a kind of magical alchemy that happens in this wok because it's this constant scooping and turning and tumbling of the ingredients in the hot well of the wok that creates this essence that is like nothing else in the world. And so you talked about the title of The Breath of a Wok, which refers to this Cantonese expression, wok hei. And hei in Cantonese is the same as qi in Mandarin. So it means life force. It's the mojo, right? And so, there's something magical that happens when the wok is hot and you put that your ingredients in, and it's this even tossing and tumbling. I interviewed a chef for Breath of a Wok, and I said to him, you know, why a wok rather than a skillet? And he looked at me like I was absolutely insane, but I was just curious to hear his answer. And he said, in a skillet, each time you scoop the ingredients, you're actually pushing all the ingredients to the other side of the pan. Whereas when you scoop each time with a wok, even if the bottom of the wok is a flat bottom wok, it still maintains the integrity of the wok shape. It is scooping, tossing, tumbling. And it's that constant motion where everything cooks evenly and it does sear. And so there's this concentrated flavor and intensity of aroma that is like nothing else in the world. When my father, he was a liquor salesman, and all of his accounts were in San Francisco's Chinatown. And so every restaurant owner was the chef. So my father knew every single chef in Chinatown. And when we'd go to a restaurant, he would insist that we sat at the table closest to the kitchen door because he wanted the least amount of time to elapse from the food coming out of the wok onto the platter to the table and into our mouths. Mm. And
that's how you taste the wok hay.
That's where you taste the wok hay. And I always say to people that it's like food right off the grill. Food right off the grill has this essence that is like, wow. 10 minutes later, it's still delicious, but it's lost that essence, that concentrated, like, it's an indescribable flavor. And my parents taught me to respect wok hay. My father was so obsessed with it. He would go into the restaurant kitchen to order all of our food, and he would come back out and say, I told the chef to add extra wok hay. You know, and you know, in Cantonese, gum go wok hay. Does it have enough wok hay? Right?
Enough? Yeah. Or the flip side of it is how my parents would talk about a restaurant and be like, oh, that's a good restaurant. Ho ya wok hay.
Exactly.
They have a lot of wok hay. You don't even say, oh, it's a good restaurant. Literally say, oh, this place, ho ya wok hay. It has a lot of wok hay.
Exactly. That's how you judge a dumpling by how thin the dumpling dough is, whether it's translucent, how many pleats the chef was able to make for the hagao, and you judge a restaurant by the stir fries and gum go wok hay. At the end of a banquet, my father would come home and analyze the meal and say, ah, tonight there was enough wok hay. You know? I grew up with this respect and this regard and this understanding. And the most beautiful part is I meet readers, you know, like people contact me. I met somebody named John from Lake Tahoe, California, who cooks from stir frying to the sky's edge. And he says to me, when I have parties, I stir fry and all the guests say, don't start stir frying till I show up. I might be a little late today because I don't want to miss the wok hay. And I think to myself, oh, my father has passed away. But because of my father, John taught all these guys in Lake Tahoe about wok hay.
Yeah. No, I love it. I totally love it. There is a magic to it.
Yeah. I rely on my wok solely, and it's a beautiful thing. And as I said, it's not just about the heat. It is the quality of your ingredients. And, you know, there's that other aspect. It's the love and passion that you have when you're cooking. So I think it's not about the oils. I think that there's a caramelization that occurs, especially with meats, right? And so it is that searing. And in my books, I call for, when you stir fry chicken, beef, pork, shrimp, I actually tell people, when you add the meat, to spread it out on the bottom of the wok and to step back and not stir fry, not touch the meat, chicken, shrimp for 1 minute. And let it begin to sear. And this is actually something that my father developed over the years. And it does work. So in China, nobody would ever do that. Yeah. No home cook, no restaurant chef would ever do it. But we are compensating on an American stove. So we're compensated by using a flat bottom wok. And we also need to compensate by, like, just allowing it to sear for a minute and then begin the stir frying.
Right on. Hey, Grace, when this is all over, let's cook together sometime, will you?
Yes, we have to.
All right.
I look forward to it.
It's been so great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for everything you're doing for Chinatown.
Thank you, Francis. And thank you for letting me talk about Chinatown.
Grace Young is the author of Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge. And over at splendidtable.org, you can find a recipe adapted from that book. Longevity noodles with ginger, chicken, and mushrooms. You can also read a terrific story about her, about how she's trying to save Chinatown in New York Magazine. You can find it at nymag.com. And last but not least, you can help her support some iconic old-line Chinese restaurants and feed hungry people by searching for the Grace Young Support Chinatown Fund on gofundme.com. That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Keep your community safe. If you can, order yourself some Chinese takeout. Get extra. The leftovers are your friend. We'll talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thanks to everyone who supports their public radio station. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday. It makes dinner a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Our show comes together because of our team, Jenny Lupke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lam, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.